The word meditate means to measure. One of its meanings is to measure. So, what could be possibly measured in meditation? If for a practice of meditation, half an hour, which is what we sit for here, we remove all sounds which we hear, disturbances, compulsive thinking, what is left is a vast silence. So, let's say someone came in late and we heard a noise of the door and it disturbed our meditation. What happened is, the mind moves to sound. It is a natural process. There is a sound, a disturbance, then the mind goes to that. It is disturbed. Then the sound is over and it comes back to rest. Now, imagine a day full of activity. And activity, I don't mean just physical activity. I mean the activity of a mind that is disturbed. A disturbed mind is disturbed by sound. And what are sounds? Words people say, things that they do. This mind is always referencing disturbance. Either what people said or did, or what I did, an event which happened which took away my peace, and so on and so forth. And this mind lives out the entire day disturbed. Now in meditation, we are giving ourselves a chance to rest in that space in which sounds arise. All sounds arise from the silence and dissolve back into silence. The silence does not disappear when the sound happens. It is the bedrock on which sounds emerge and dissolve. So the sage who looks so calm and peaceful, his or her mind is not disturbed like the ordinary mind. It has found its equanimity through the rough and tumble of the day. That is the only difference. So the sage is in tune with this vast ocean of silence during the course of the day. An event may happen which temporarily takes the sage out of that silence, but it is so spontaneous and there is no involvement in that event and the sage goes back into that silence. But we carry the story in the duration of time. So the silence of the mind is what everyone is aspiring to, but they don't know it. We have been born with this aspiration because this is an incarnation of discovery. Am I here just to work? Am I here just to be a good person in the eyes of others? Am I here to win people's love? What am I here for? What am I doing? What am I thinking? This is meditation. Are my thoughts harmful thoughts? Harming others in my thoughts. I may be too chicken to tell them on their face, but I think bad of them is enough because that is the data in my consciousness. The harm has already been done to me. Thinking I wish them harm because after all, there is only one consciousness. Now the content of that consciousness has become harmful, full of harm. You see how subtle this understanding is. The more there are people in your life who you wish harm upon or ill will towards, the more the content of your own consciousness is full of that. So the joke is on you, not on the other, because it is your peace that has got destroyed. Other has really no idea what's going on in your mind, probably doesn't care. So this is the quest. How deep is this peace? Can it be measured? Can silence be measured? It is so vast. Individuals can be measured. Objects can be measured. But whether it is a bird chirping or an explosion of fireworks, they both come and go. That silence remains. So imagine all our lives we are chasing sounds, whereas the ground of being is silence. We are chasing experiences. And on the spiritual path, we are chasing spiritual experiences. But that silence does not complain, does not object. It is just there. And that silence is referred to as pure being. It is alive, pure being. But that pure being is not alluring to the one mesmerized by life and by the story. That is the Maya. Till the point comes when one is tired of the Maya, the grip it has on me, up one day, down the next, pleasure one day, pain the next. And then to realize, what is that which does not come and go? If I am established as that, life is simple. The sage witnesses the movie of their life on the screen of consciousness. The sage is not lost in the movie. The ordinary person is lost. Then that becomes the purpose of life. In simple words, to let life flow. In spiritual terminology, realizing the self. But basically and fundamentally, it is a reversal into that pure being. All concepts, notions, thoughts about people, how they should behave, how I should behave, what they should do, what I should do, have dissolved. Because the realization is that there is obviously a higher power running the show. It really doesn't need my help. Can you switch the light on, please? Would anyone like to ask something or share their meditation experience?
I just want to know what happens when thoughts spiral out of control. You know, I mean, just this incident that happened where my help had gone, you know, she had her son had taken ill, and she left immediately. I told her, yeah, you can go. But after that, there was a gap between communication. You know, she could not get through because she was in the village. And that's when my thoughts went, you know, spiraling. I'm only thinking, hope nothing untoward has happened. You know, all the time it was, maybe this has happened, maybe it was all negative.
Yes.
So
means hope nothing has happened to her son?
Her son and herself.
And herself.
And herself. Because 4 years ago when she came to me, I think after some time her husband got murdered. And this was done by two brothers who wanted the property that was left. So, I mean, they were put into prison. And it went into legal, in a legal way. But thankfully, she got the property. And the only thing she used to say, now at least I am at peace, because now I know even if I go, the children, the two sons will be taken care of.
So did she get in touch with you after going to the village?
No, she did not. That was what was worrying, very worrying.
So there's no contact with her?
No, but she's come back now, of course.
Oh, she has come
she
back.
She has come back. And she said her son was very seriously ill. And he was operated upon. So I could understand her position if I put myself and my child is not well. I mean, one only thinks that hopefully everything will go well. But in the meantime, you know, my mind was working in the opposite
way. Of course. So, that is the mind. See, the mind feeds on fear. It is the nature of the mind. Fear of the future. What could happen? And that fear is ultimately the fear of death.
Yeah.
One is fearing about the other, but also fearing what will happen to me. It's all connected. Now, does a sage feel fear, or is the sage fearless? If fear is meant to arise, it will arise even in the sage, because it is a possibility. Something going wrong is a possibility.
Yes, that's it.
But in the sage, the fear will arise, the sage will witness the fear, is aware of the fear, and the fear will drop. The ordinary person clings on to that thought of fear and then builds stories upon it. and that causes psychological suffering. Whereas the sage knows that whatever is meant to happen is going to happen. Me being fearful or not is quite irrelevant. If the body-mind organism is designed to be fearful, let's say it's a timid sage and has been conditioned a certain way, fear will arise, but no ownership will be taken about that fear. The sage does not say, I should not be fearful. The ordinary person says, I should not be fearful. Because the ordinary person has taken ownership of the fear as my fear. I should not be like this. Why am I like this? Why am I disturbing my peace? That does not happen for a sage. So the sage will not suffer the fear psychologically in the duration of time. It will dissolve. Then maybe after a day, again the thought comes, something could have happened to them. Again it will arise, again it will dissolve. But it is just a movement, a spontaneous movement, which is not latched onto by the sage. We latch onto it, and it is these fears which then become toxic. Toxicity starts building up in our energy field, in our aura, in our body, because the ego is afraid to die. And so many of us live lives of terror and fear unconsciously. The one on the spiritual path is conscious, living through the fears and terrors consciously, which means it can even burn stronger because now you're aware of it. But that is the fire of spiritual knowledge, to burn this all up and to discover that this is the nature of life. Imagine if the caretaker looking after me does not come back. Yeah. Who will take care of me? Will I find someone as good as her? And so on and so forth. Now, that is a natural process. But when we get subsumed and consumed by this fear, that is when the problems begin. It happens to the extent that we no longer can operate in the day. We are riddled with fear. That becomes a problem.
No, I knew my thoughts were getting out of control. And in the end, I said, okay, it doesn't matter. I'm surrendering like. And after that, I was more calm. Not that the thoughts didn't arise. They did arise still, but in a calmer manner, you know. So I'm happy she's back. And you're right when you say, okay, I was only thinking of how will the next caretaker be? And will I be able to adjust?
Yes, of course. And it's valid. It's a valid question. It's a natural question which arises. You know, a very interesting true life story. I hope I'm not getting it wrong. It's there on the net. But the gist of it is that there was an enlightened being called Morris Friedman. He is the one who brought out the book, I Am That. By translating it, it was Nisargadatta Maharaj's talks. Morris Friedman translated it, and it came out as the English edition of I Am That. Morris Friedman was an amazing man. He was connected with the Dalai Lama, Krishnamurti, Ramana Maharshi. Finally, he was at Maharaj. He was getting old, and he was single. Nobody to look after him, but he did what he did, tried his best. It didn't bother him. And then one lady came from nowhere to take care of him. And when she was asked, what brought you here? She said she had a dream of a man saying, go and look after him. And discovered that was Ramana Maharshi. So, you see, the source finds ways to look after you. Your fear is based on your story, which is based on your life's experiences. Imagine a child who grew up with a lot of negativity in the household, lot of loss. That child is naturally fearful. Someone may not have that conditioning, fortunately, and there may not be that kind of a quotient of fear. So the spiritual journey is about releasing this grip on fear as my fear. Just let it be. When it's meant to arise, it arises. When it's not meant to, it doesn't. So be it. I don't judge myself for it. And yet, as you are seeing, you're aware that these fearful thoughts are arising, where they are taking you, that's all that can be done. But when we rest more and more in the knowing that whatever happens is the will of God, thy will be done, we find that by and by there's lesser and lesser and lesser fearful thinking. By and by.
And I also told myself, I mean, nothing is permanent, so why do I expect that she will be with me all the time? You know, that thought also.
And it's a logical thought, but sometimes it does not give relief. Sometimes it does. See, it's amazing the child does not have these thoughts because they are taken care of. It does not have to think who will look after me. The adult does not want to die. If I'm not looked after, I'm going to die. That source which brought us into the incarnation is forgotten. It's not going to look after me. I have to look after myself. That is the overriding thought. That Shakti coming from the mother's womb, nobody comes from the father's womb. That Shakti, that divine force which is the reason for my incarnation, the ego has set aside as irrelevant. The spurious ego. And it is this ego which thinks, I am the commander in chief. Then when the ego gets a few slaps along the way, it realizes, perhaps I'm not the commander in chief. Then it goes back to its old ways, again a few slaps. At some point it says, I give up. That is surrender. And that surrender is the birth of love. Because that sense of separation is now given a chance to break. So they are linked. The words surrender and love and trust. It's like a triangle with surrender, trust, love. Because if you don't trust someone, it means you don't love them. You cannot surrender without trusting in a higher power. And when you surrender, the foundation of that is love. Not for me and mine, but love for that force which brought me in, which I forgot, which looks after everyone according to a plan I can't fathom. The Divine Mother looks after all her children, especially the ones I don't like. That realization that the ones I don't like, the ones who have pushed my buttons the most, are looked after by the same Divine Mother as me. Isn't that love? So these are maybe simple words, but they are loaded. One has to be careful when one uses these words, surrender, trust, and love. Because 99% of the time we are fooling ourselves. 99% of the times when we say we love someone, we don't. It is an exchange. They validate me, so I love them. They give me something, so I love them. 99% of the time when I say I trust someone, I don't. Because I cannot trust them if I don't love them. And 99.99% of the time when I say I have surrendered, I haven't. Because to surrender means your will simply does not operate. Now you'll have situations where people will go to a spiritual master and say, I've surrendered to you. And the master will give an instruction and then they will go back home and decide, should I do it or should I not? You see, I don't think what he is saying is quite correct. So I'm going to wait on deciding whether to listen to him or not. Is that surrender? That is a negotiation. In the olden days, the guru-disciple relationship was far purer. There was a purity to that.
Correct me if I have, if my observation is like correct. So what I have realized, like, you know, in joy, most of the time, the me is not that prominent. But in the suffering, the me is clearly shown, like, you know, it just stands up. Because in suffering, me is the center. So, you know, I was just contemplating these days, like, why we resist suffering so much, because it is in the light of the suffering when ego is fully exposed. And it is that blessing in disguise that we come nearer to God. So in one way, we want to get nearer to the God also, but we don't want suffering also. But I don't think so it goes Other way around.
Yeah, enjoy being.
You know, there's that saying, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so this is, yeah.
See, joy is a separate thing. Pleasure, if you're referring to pleasure versus suffering, those are, you could say, the polaric opposites. Like, pleasure does not make me afraid of death. Suffering does.
I have to sit with that to see, yes.
Why am I suffering? If I have a financial loss, what will happen? I will die. The Buddhists were quite right. All forms of fear are connected to the fear of death. I lose a relationship, I have a girlfriend and she's gone. Who will I be without her? What will happen to me? Fear of death. Health. Something happened to me, I'm not recovering from this viral, it's been 3 weeks. What will happen to me? Death. So suffering, in that sense of what you are saying, brings me closer to wondering what this is about, because in all these cases, I will die. Now, if I win the lottery, I'm not going to say I will die.
Exactly.
That is pleasure. If I have success in business, pleasure. If I find a new girlfriend who's really hot, even more pleasure. But in that pleasure, the ego is getting set up for the downfall, because it is the polaric opposite of pain. That same lottery, there are so many instances where you read people who have won lotteries and gone bankrupt in 5 years. It's all over the net. That same girlfriend who you thought was the Devi in form, you basically said, what happened here? Yeah, I can't handle this anymore. So you see, what's happening is pleasure is setting me up to see how transient they are, and suffering is provided to me to see how afraid I am to die. So they are two ends of the same stick. But it appears that suffering makes me suffer more than the pleasures. But even the pleasures are connected to death. Now what happens? I give this example often. I have a friend who is very wealthy, who loves buying new cars. So he'll buy a new Mercedes. After 1 year, he wants another car. He's got bored of the Mercedes. So what has happened? He has died to his pleasure derived from the first Mercedes. Now he is seeking another pleasure to keep that feeling of pleasure alive. Then the next car, then the next car. You see, the journey is of death. Till a point is reached that nothing in this world can give me permanent pleasure. You know, in economics, we had the law of diminishing marginal utility, which was a very simple law. The pleasure you derive from the first apple you eat is great. Now you eat the second apple, you will not derive as much pleasure as you did from the first. And from the third, you will not derive as much as you did from the second. This is the law of life. Our attachment to objects. Life only destroys our attachment, but then we hanker. We want another apple and another apple, then another apple. Imagine from the first apple's pleasure to your 52nd apple. Then you look for other pleasures, because you're stuck in the pleasure-pain loop. Other things that can make you happy, even those disappoint you. All of us live our lives like this, hankering after pleasures, running away from pains. This matrix, this unending story, at some point in some people, when this flame of awareness is ignited, then this running away stops. That is what Maharaj calls that point in life when you now realize there's no point running away from pain and suffering. I might as well turn around and face it. That point is a peak point, because the ego is now ready to turn around and face its death. That is the start of the spiritual journey. When I find I'm enjoying pleasures, why not? But I'm no longer dependent on them for my happiness. And I'm suffering pains. I'm not running away from them, yet I am suffering them. But I've realized escaping is of no use, because they come running after me. That marks an irreversible process, because that is the beginning of the end of the past. Then I'm ready to say, let what comes, come.
You know, in last session you said something very wonderful. You used this word again, but this, like, you know, most of the time we use spirituality for escaping. So this was something very beautiful. Like, you know, it just, like, you know, something, it happens, like, am I escaping or am I ready to face it?
You have to see your own life. Are you ready to face all the characters in this living dream of your life without judging and condemning them? Yes, we all have our preferences, but do we see the hand of God above everyone? Then you know you're not escaping. Am I on a superior spiritual path than others? That is a judgment. How do you know? They may be more at peace. We don't know. So I'm concerned with my peace, my sukha shanti. I stop comparing and judging. At the same time, I do ask myself that am I clear where my peace is to be found? Because I might be going somewhere else just out of peer pressure or habit, but I'm not peaceful there. Then I ask myself, where am I peaceful? With whom am I peaceful? That is why Shankaracharya and all the seers used to say that satsang, the company of saints, the company of pure beings is of immeasurable value. Because just by being in that field, in that space, it rubs off on you. You can even go to a satsang and you don't understand a word that is being said, but something pulls you there. So it is really a gift to be able to go to such spaces, any place where you feel a sense of peace. It could be a friend's home, where you know you're not struggling to put on a pretense so that they like you and approve of you. They may just be the quiet type and you always feel you're yourself there. Find those out. Stop playing the game. Stop wearing masks. How long are you going to do it? Life is the ashram. I said it last time, I think. You go to the ashram and you'll be hounded there by different personalities who are troubling you. Enough is provided by life. That is also escaping. I'm trying to run away from this troubled existence of mine. All the best, it's going to come after you.
Before I ask my question, can you turn the AC down?
Sorry?
The AC.
Of course. Can someone switch one of the ACs off? Can switch that one off. Even I find it very cold sometimes, but they don't listen to me, these people. And then when I ask who made it cold, they keep quiet, so I don't know who is the culprit. These are all strategies of deflection. There you go. Yes.
Thank you. How can I abide more in the witnessing stage?
You really don't need to do anything to abide more and more in the witnessing state. When you start seeing life through the prism of the teaching, when you start seeing situations, people, through this new way of seeing, earlier, for example, you held people accountable and responsible for their actions and you judged them. Now, the new way of seeing has informed you that everyone acts based on their conditioning, which they didn't create in the first place. It is their set of life experiences, their nature, their geographic environment, socio-economic environment, religion, which has shaped them. So this new way of seeing, when you look at that same person in your life through this lens, by and by, witnessing will happen on its own. You don't have to do the witnessing. You have to allow the teaching to work through you. That is the only doing needed. Even that needn't be done, because if it has already appealed to you, it will do the job. And you will soon see life will give you the same people, different people, but your vision starts changing about them. So witnessing happens on its own. The ego is not needed to enhance the witnessing. Yes, the attempt needs to be made. For example, if I have enough people I have blamed and condemned all my life, then every day I must sit with myself for 15 minutes and ask myself, today, whom did I blame and condemn? That is what is called sadhana. And then I see those same people in the light of the new understanding I have received, and that does what Joel Goldsmith calls the reinterpretation. Now I am not interpreting them through my earlier conditioning, I am interpreting them through the new conditioning. And as I interpret them through the new conditioning, I find I am more and more peaceful and less resistant to them. So that is what happens. So it will then happen as a natural progression on the spiritual journey, that you are not offended easily, nor do you offend others, because you really have a sense of felt oneness with being. Why would you want to take away someone else's peace when you know how precious your peace is? So earlier there's a disregard for this. You want to get back at people. They did this to me, I'm going to give it to them. Now you know your peace is so precious, you feel, why would I want to take away this person's peace? So the words which come out, the things I say, the things I do is no longer like a tennis match which I've been playing constantly. Now I say, all right, now it's enough. I'll put the racket down and let's see how things flow. So if someone has a point of view different from yours, you allow them their point of view. Earlier you resisted. No, I am right, you are wrong. But now the thinking is, you are right from your point of view, because your point of view is based on your background, your conditioning. Then how can anyone be wrong? I am right from my point of view, but both are simply points of view. So this game of right-wrong is also given up. What happens then? Witnessing. Earlier agitation. How dare you say this? Now, an acceptance. I may still not agree with you. My point of view is different, but I am no longer agitated. Witnessing. What a discovery it is. This witnessing is like nectar. It feels so wonderful to have in the mouth. And you really tell yourself, my God, I've changed. I'm witnessing more and more the movie of my life. Earlier I was lost in it. Sakshi Bhav. Witness consciousness. And it is true, because consciousness is consciousness. It's neutral. It only witnesses. Yes. This is your first time?
No, it's my second time.
Okay.
I came here last time.
Okay.
About angels you mentioned.
Oh, yes, of course. So your Bhavna.
Yes. Thank you. Okay. Remember my name.
Good memory.
Yeah. So... So coming back,
tell
to
them, because the volunteers think I have a very bad memory. They have to keep repeating the same thing. You know, there was when Nisargadatta Maharaj was old, he went with his translator Mullarpattan for a walk on the streets of Khetwadi. So there was someone selling, you know, they put their mat and they sell plastic toys, and there was someone selling plastic combs. So Maharaj went down on his haunches and was looking at the combs and wanted to take one. So Mullarpattan told me, he said, I told Maharaj, Maharaj, but you don't have any hair left. He said, oh. Yeah, sorry.
A build up on what was just discussed. So let's say if you're I'm a teacher and I'm contributing towards 22 children in my class, and I have a colleague that I'm working with, and say for example I have that understanding that I don't want to hold the racket, I have put the racket down, right? But I can sense the coldness, can sense the person is intimidated by my capability. And I can sense it, sir, okay? I can sense it. I'm not doing anything about it. But at the same time, my intention is I have an academic year to finish. I want to do it with peace, harmony, understanding, so these children benefit. It's not about, I come from that space, but it's not necessary that the other person does. Mm-hmm. So how do I make this equation work where, listen, I don't have any ill feelings for you. I don't want to be in the competitive space. I just want to contribute here. And so if you have that understanding but the other person doesn't, then how do you make that equation work?
You are concerned only with your understanding. Are you familiar with the concept of Rinanubandhan?
Like karmic connection? Is that
what? Basically, as Shirdi Sai Baba says, everyone you meet in your life is on account of Rinanubandhan, which loosely translated would be the cosmic debt of a prior incarnation, you could say, or whatever. It's irrelevant really, because we are concerned with the here and now. So two people have come together who don't get along, right? Now you are concerned with only your vision. Are you able to see that this person is not the doer of their actions? That is the first step.
How can they not be the doer of their action?
That is what the whole Bhagavad Gita is about. That is precisely the point. When Krishna tells Arjuna, the ego deluded thinks I am the doer. That is the whole point, that this person I don't get along with is operating on a script which was not written by them.
But sir, I want to get along. I want to
have
this.
One minute. When I see that they are saying and doing things based on their conditioning, their programming, their nature, they are not the doers of their actions, I have released them from any judgment. That is the first step. It is not, let me do my job, let me take care of the kids. That is all fine. The first thing is, and it is a very common situation in offices, in places of work, where you don't get along with someone. It is an opportunity to absolve this person of doership. What happens is, I take it personally because I'm at the receiving end. Mm. So this me says that this person is a threat to me, and this person feels I am a threat to them. Now it is to me which is the problem. That person is being who they are. So first, within my own consciousness, have I absolved them of being the doers of their actions?
Sorry, sir, what do you mean by absolved?
Means I don't hold them accountable and I have not judged them.
Okay.
Pain may arise based on what they are saying and doing. Mm. But within my own consciousness, I have made peace with them. Let's say in this building, there is someone I don't get along with. Mm. But I totally accept they are precisely the way they are made by God. And if they are meant to trouble me, that is part of the divine script. Now I am no longer battling an individual. Earlier, I am obsessed with battling a person. That obsession goes. Now I have a situation. Now when I see this is a situation I am placed in, it's no longer personal. What happens is, I allow myself the opportunity to now respond through my intellect, not through my mind, which was trying to defend myself. That is the dawn of the intellect. Now I have to see, I have to navigate my way out of this, but I have given up this game of doership. So what could happen is surprising things. For example, I may find that something I could not conceive of, sitting face to face with this person and having a frank chat. Now I may say, let me see what happens. It's the field of infinite possibilities, because now I have really understood nobody is the doer of their actions.
आपके कहने का मतलब है कि उनसे करवाया जा रहा है।
Yes, just like with you. Now it is a game changer.
But sir, what if my intention is not to get into this? Sir, do you understand, sir? Let's say I want to have a positive partnership because I want the kids to benefit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So all you can do is try. All you can do is try.
But not get affected by what I'm receiving is what you're trying to say, right?
Because you're taking delivery of it. Do come again. Today's session is almost over. But you see, I'll tell you, if there's someone in my life, let's say not this person who's troubling me, let's say I have a problem with this person in my life, right? A certain aspect I don't like about her. Now when I see it in a new light and I resolve my dislike, I've understood it in the light of clarity, then that dislike operates for everyone because it no longer will arise. So let's say she has a personality trait which I dislike and I've resolved it within myself. Tomorrow I will not hold anyone else liable for that personality trait which they also have, because it is resolved in my own consciousness. This person is there to teach you that he is not the doer of his actions. It does not mean an outcome is guaranteed, but it means you will be freed of this burden of he is doing this to me. Why is he not leaving me alone to do my job? That is not the destiny. It is meant to be worked out in whatever way, but to realize the hand of God is above both of you. Yet you must take steps if you have to protect yourself, if you have to do certain things, but you are no longer targeting an individual. So simple. If we keep targeting individuals, God will give us more and more individuals to target. Target practice. It's true. There are 6 billion of them.
Seven billion.
So you have 7 billion people you may not get along with. But if you see the source is one, it's finished.